We need to zoom out a bit this week and get our bearings. We've been through the opening of the seven seals on the scroll. We saw how the seventh seal wasn't really an event in itself, but was made up of seven trumpets, the last three of which were so terrible they are called the three woes. There are still seven bowls to come, but those won't happen for a bit. Because John is about to spiral back through the story and give us some more depth and context. If you remember from a couple of weeks ago, Revelation is not laid out in the strictly chronological way we Westerners are accustomed to. John is telling the story in a much more Eastern style, in which he gives the outer shape of the story, telling us the beginning and the ending, and then spirals back over and over, giving us more detail each time as he builds towards the climax. For example, in last week's class, we saw a period of 3.5 years a couple of times. There were the 3.5 years the two witnesses testify in Jerusalem, and we saw the 3.5 years that God's people were to be handed over to the boastful horn in Daniel's dream. The woman wearing the laurel crown of 12 stars hides in the desert for 3.5 years. And the red dragon goes off to wage war on the woman's other offspring, which we'll find out will be for 3.5 years. Are these all different time periods that happen one after the other? Or are they the same 3.5 years that John is spiraling back to over and over? Well, Eastern storytelling like this is like a painting in which the artist sketches the shapes roughly in charcoal first, then adds line drawings, and then adds color, and finally adds shading to make it fully dimensional. Since our Western minds get thoroughly turned around by this kind of storytelling, this seems like a good time to stop and look at our map. Wait, there's a map? What map? Yes, there is. And I'll tell you where it is. You'll laugh. It's in the Hebrew Bible, in the book of Daniel. Of course it is. John is basing his work on Daniel's prophecies from the Babylonian exile, and he's filling in all the detail he understands within his own context in the Roman Empire. So it will really help to look at John's starting point in Daniel. At the end of Daniel 9, the Archangel Gabriel gives Daniel an interpretation of some of his visions. Gabriel tells him it will take 70 sevens for everything to be fulfilled that must be. Now, the Hebrew word for seven, in the context of a time period just means seven somethings, whether it's 7 days or 7 months or 7 years, depends on the context. The angel has a whole list of things to be fulfilled. So, to determine what length these quote sevens are, we need to know what has to be fulfilled in this time frame. Gabriel says that during this period, the Jews will restrain or push back the revolt. Now, most translations say finish the transgression, but I think we lose the connotation of the words if we call it transgression, which has a lot of baggage for us. And yes, the Hebrew word transgression does mean sin, but the specific sin in view with this particular word is rebellion or revolt. Now, during this time, sin, vision, and prophecy will all be sealed. Just imagine these things being rolled up in a scroll and sealed. The idea seems to be they will come to an end. Sin will end. And when all visions and prophecies have been fulfilled and the end has come, there will be no more need for them. Guilt will be covered over, atoned for. Think mercy seat here, same root word. Eternal righteousness and justice will enter. Righteousness and justice are the same exact word in Hebrew. And finally, the most holy will be anointed. Now, most translations insert the word place here, but in the Hebrew Bible, anointing is typically done for priests and kings. So it is much more likely to mean the most holy one, as in anointing Jesus as king. And that's the translation I think makes the most sense. Overall, this is a picture of everything finally coming to fruition and completion in the end time. So, whatever time periods these are, they have to take us all the way to the very end. Now, fortunately, Gabriel gives Daniel some more specific information as to the timeline involved. He says the 77s begin when the decree is issued for Jerusalem to be rebuilt. Now, Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians, and we know from later biblical record in Nehemiah 1 that this decree was issued in March or April of 444 BCE. Now, the book of Daniel is set during the Babylonian captivity, which is roughly 100, 150 years earlier than this. But based on textual evidence in the book, most scholars believe Daniel was actually written in retrospect around 165 BCE. And I also tend to go with the later date. Then Gabriel says there will be seven, quote, sevens and 62 sevens. Now, no one knows for sure why Gabriel broke this total of 69 sevens into these two pieces. Now, assuming this quote sevens represent sets of seven Hebrew lunar years, the first set of sevens would end around 396 BCE. Now, I searched to see what happened in that year. The nascent Roman Republic succeeds that year after a 10-year siege, doubling their territory. This is their very first major expansion. I think it makes a ton of sense that the first break marks what could fairly be said to be the beginning of the Roman Empire. Now, P.S., if you were in the class series on the exile and the return, you may remember that at that time, I couldn't find any significance for this break at 396. So I'm glad I thought to double check while I was writing this class series on Revelation. This makes perfect sense to me. I mentioned lunar years a moment ago. We have to remember that the Hebrews did not count in 365 day years like we do. They used a lunar month of 30 days with 360 days per year. So if we do the math on a 69 sets of lunar years, that's 173,880 days. If we convert that to our 365 day years, that would be 476 years. It's 444 years to point zero, which is where we switch from BCE to Common Era. A total of 476 years, which the angel is prophesying, would make the end of the 70 of the 69 sevens fall at 32 Common Era. What significant historical event happened around that time? You've got it. Jesus was crucified. I personally think the best estimate of the year Jesus was crucified is 30 Common Era, but close enough, 30, 32, whatever. And what's absolutely crazy is that Gabriel says that the end of the 69 sevens is when the Messiah, the prince or ruler, will come and then will be put to death. Isn't that amazing? Even though there's argument among scholars about when Daniel was actually written, everyone agrees it was written at least 150 years before Jesus was even born. So this is a remarkable prophecy, no matter what date you assign to Daniel. After the 69 sevens, Gabriel says, Jerusalem and the temple will be destroyed. And that actually happens in 70 Common Era. That's a lot later than seven more years after the death of Christ. So Gabriel has only really accounted for 69 of the 70 sevens. What about that last set of 7 years, the 70th seven? Where does it fit in? All we know is that there must be a gap after the end of the 69 sevens. And that makes sense because otherwise Gabriel would have just said there will be 70 sevens. But he said there will be seven sevens plus 62 sevens for a total of 69, and then the end will come. He didn't tell us how long that gap is between the end of the 69 sevens, which marks the death of the Messiah, and the very end, the final seven. Gabriel just says that wars will continue until the end, and the desolations decreed happen. But even though he doesn't give a timeline, he does have something to say about the events of the final set of 7 years, whenever they do occur. Gabriel says the ruler during that time will come from the people who destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. Ah, that's the Roman Empire. That is a historical fact. It may or may not have happened when John wrote Revelation, but Rome was certainly a grave threat to Jerusalem and the temple, even if John was writing before 70 Common Era. We, however, are 1500 years past the fall of the Roman Empire. So if the ruler during the last set of sevens is from the people of the Roman Empire, is this a spiritual view of him? Does he rule in this sort of quote empire tradition? All of this is open for interpretation, but Christians generally see Western civilization and democracy, as well as its military aggression and expansion of technology, as a continuation of the Roman footprint in the world. If you're going to try to take Revelation literally, you would have to agree with this. And it's frankly not a big stretch. So, whenever this final 7 years begins, this ruler from the people of the Roman Empire will make a treaty for 1 7. So, a treaty for 7 years. And it says this treaty is with, quote, many. Gabriel doesn't exactly specify who this might be. But Gabriel says in the middle of this seven, this ruler will stop sacrifice and offering. So that makes it sound like this treaty may have originally been with the Jews to allow them to restart worship in the temple, and that the ruler reneges on the treaty halfway through. A temple doesn't exist nowadays, and I can't imagine that we'd ever restart animal sacrifices, but I can imagine Israel being all over any offer of rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem, right? Even right now, even today. I can imagine that sacrifice and offering might be monetary or acts of service or something symbolic but costly. John most likely saw this as a literal restart of animal sacrifices after destruction of the temple by the Roman Empire. He's looking for a rebuild of the temple and a restart of animal sacrifices. And this could be a strong argument in support of those who think John wrote Revelation around 90 Common Era and that he actually witnessed the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in his time, in his lifetime. We know he did in his lifetime. So look what splitting the final 7 years in half would mean. That would mean there's 3.5 years before this treaty is abruptly ended, and another 3.5 years after that. Sounds more and more like Revelation, doesn't it? I'm beginning to see where John is getting his 3.5 year periods from. The Hebrew is awkward to translate into English here, but when this treaty is broken, Gabriel says, on the wing or edge of abominations will be the one who causes desolation or devastation until his destruction is poured out on him. Now, this seems to be associated with the breaking of the treaty related to the temple. So it seems likely that the temple, once it's rebuilt, will be horribly desecrated in the middle of that 7 years by this ruler until he himself is finally destroyed, presumably at the second coming of Jesus. So we're still back in Daniel, right? We're talking about how what the angel is saying way back in Daniel. In the vision in chapter 7 of Daniel about the beast with 10 horns and that one boastful horn or ruler. Horns are rulers in biblical prophecy. The angel tells Daniel that by his cunning, this ruler will cause deceit and treachery to be profitable, and he will exalt himself and destroy many in their prosperity. He will even exalt himself against the Prince of Princes, presumably Jesus, but he will be broken without human intervention. Daniel is told that this ruler will speak pompous words against the Most High and will continually harass the people of the Most High. He will make plans to change the times and the laws, and the holy people will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. That's 3.5 years, a year, years, and half a year. That would be the second half of the final 7 years because it's after the desecration of the temple. But the court, now Daniel, the prophecy in Daniel is speaking of a heavenly court here. The court will sit and will strip this ruler of his dominion and destroy it forever. And the sovereignty of all the kingdoms under heaven will be given to the people of the Most High, whose sovereignty is over all kingdoms forever and ever. So to summarize, this deceitful ruler, who is the little horn that arises out of the people of the Roman Empire, will rule during the 70th set of 7 years, called the 70th seven for short. He exalts himself and double crosses those who prosper under him. He'll start up by cozying up to the Jews, but after the first 3.5 years, he'll break their agreement and desecrate the temple, stopping all offerings and sacrifices. Then, during the second 3.5 years, he actively opposes God and sets himself up against God. God's people, presumably Israel, certainly in John's eyes, will be given over to this ruler, and there will be great distress while this ruler oppresses them. Then the end will come. Now, peppered throughout Daniel's visions about this period are several specific time frames within this 7-year period. I'm not sure they're all that helpful as they don't add much more than what we've got here. I'll give you a link in the study guide to a chart showing all this detail in case you want to look at it. For our study of Revelation, it's this final 70th seven that John is embellishing on. And he sees it as happening very soon. And it really helps to have this general map in mind so we can keep the various 3.5 years in order. So let's see where the things fit that we've already covered. We've had all those events of the first seven seals and trumpets. Those have been pretty extreme. And it's possible they span the entire 7-year period. But I tend to think they happen during the first 3.5 years. Now, this entire 7-year period is aptly called the tribulation. But things get a lot worse in the second half, so that second half is called the Great Tribulation. Also, during this time, we know the Jews are in the temple because John was told to measure the temple precincts where they're worshiping. And this tells us that at some point, a temple gets rebuilt in Jerusalem. Sacrifices and offerings are being made, and we know that this is being allowed there under an agreement with the boastful ruler. But we also know John is told the Gentiles will be trampling Jerusalem during this period, and that makes sense given the shenanigans the boastful ruler is up to. It is during this time that the two witnesses prophesy in the city, defending themselves with fire from their mouths and causing drought and plagues. After 3.5 years, they are killed by a beast that comes up out of the abyss. Now, we're going to find out a whole lot more about this beast, but this beast appears in the midpoint of the tribulation. So, where in all this? Does the spiral fit that talks about the woman who is crowned with the sun, the moon, and the 12 stars? And where does that red dragon fit who's waiting for her to give birth? Now, I'm thinking that that spiral of the story doesn't fit neatly into this 70th seven. I think we need to zoom back out to see where the story fits. As we discussed in our last class, that woman is pretty clearly Israel, and she's about to give birth to Jesus. So that puts her here on the timeline. And Satan, the red dragon with seven heads crowned with diadems and 10 horns, waits for the birth of this king, but the child is snatched away from him. Well, we know Jesus is crucified at the end of the first 69 sevens, and I can imagine that Satan felt like Jesus was snatched from him when Jesus was resurrected. In John's story, Satan then goes off in a rage to make war on the rest of the woman's offspring. What is super interesting to me is that it is at this point that John describes the great battle in heaven between Satan and his forces and the Archangel Michael and his forces. And when Satan loses, he loses his place in heaven and his throne to earth. He retains all his power, but he loses his place. It is here that a loud voice in heaven declares, "Now the salvation and power and kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah Christ have come because our accuser has been thrown down. They overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb, the word of their witness or testimony, and because they were willing to sacrifice their lives. Rejoice, O heavens, but woe to the earth and the sea, for the devil is furious because he knows his time is short." So, seeing the timelines together like this is so helpful. It puts a new spin on the significance of the resurrection. It is the time in which Satan is thrown down to earth, the time in which he loses his place in heaven, even though he retains his power. So, this is the time we're living in now, right? This goes a long way towards explaining the intensity of evil in the world today. In John's story, the woman then flees to a place in the wilderness that has been prepared for her by God, and she hides there 3.5 years. Now, remember that when John writes Revelation, Jesus has already been resurrected. John knows his seven churches are facing an immediate period of tribulation and persecution. He's trying to set their coming struggles in a frame of cosmic importance in direct relation to Jesus' resurrection. John is a student of the Hebrew Bible. He believes they have now come to Daniel's 70th seven. So when John says the woman Israel flees to the wilderness for 3.5 years, he's talking about Daniel's first 3.5 years. He thinks it's starting now. He doesn't know there's going to be a 2,000-year gap. So we have to remove that gap when we're interpreting Revelation, or we will misinterpret it. And most interpreters forget to do this. Most interpreters will tell you the 3.5 years is that period when Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus were hiding in Egypt. But it doesn't make sense for John to refer to that event in this context. It makes much more sense if you realize he's actually referring to the first half of the 70th seven. John just thinks there's no more gap in the timeline. All right, so all this stuff about the woman, the red dragon, and the wilderness is the spiritual view. The literal view, as we've seen, is that during the first 3.5 years, the Gentiles are allowed to trample Jerusalem, but because of that treaty, they're not allowed to prevent temple worship. Phew, all right, pause for a breath. We've synced our timelines between Daniel and Revelation. We have this overall map in our head now, and we're ready to pick up John's story. We are at the midpoint of the 70th seven. John has cryptically said that a beast from the abyss kills the two witnesses, but they're resurrected and taken to heaven. And now we get to some of the most famous parts of Revelation. This next bit is another spiral. John's going to spiral back and give us the backstory of this beast from the abyss. This is a spiritual view. We know that because it starts with the red dragon. As the scene opens, the dragon stands upon the sands of the sea. He calls forth a beast with seven heads and 10 horns with 10 diadems. Now, wait a minute, that sounds familiar. The dragon also has seven heads and 10 horns. The difference is that the royal diadems are not on the heads of the beast like they are on the dragon, but are on its horns. The diadems are on the kings or rulers who represent this beast. That's interesting. The red dragon, Satan, has called forth a beast made in his own image. On each of the beast's seven heads is a blasphemous name. John says the beast looks sort of like a leopard, has feet like a bear, the mouth of a lion. Well, all of those were characteristics of the first three beasts that were in Daniel's vision. They represented empires that preceded and gave birth to the Roman Empire. What's super important, though, is that the dragon gives this beast his power, his throne, and his immediate jurisdiction. Now, this is a big deal. John is saying the Roman Empire transfers its power and jurisdiction to this beast. Now, right off the bat, John notices that one of the beast's seven heads looks like it had received a fatal wound. But the fatal wound has been healed, and the whole earth is amazed at that. People worship the beast because of all of this, and also worship the dragon because they realize he was the one who gave all this power to the beast. Now, honestly, this is a sick and twisted imitation of God the Father and Jesus the Son, isn't it? Well, it gets worse. The beast is allowed to blaspheme God and all that is holy for 3.5 years. We knew that. The beast must be the spiritual representation of the ruler described by Daniel, the ruler who is given power during the 70th seven. And we know from Daniel that in the second 3.5 years, he will break the treaty and will begin persecuting the people of Israel. So pause here a minute. Back in chapter 11, John told us the two witnesses would be killed by, quote, the beast coming up out of the abyss. Now, when we read that, we didn't have any idea what beast John was talking about. But now that he's spiraled back and given us the beast's backstory, we know that the beast that kills the two witnesses is the same beast the dragon calls out of the sea in chapter 13. So in chapter 13, the beast is called from the sea, whereas in chapter 11, John says he was from the abyss. Both of these are spiritual views, but one is in the chapter about the two witnesses, and the other is in the chapter that gives the beast backstory. And that means that John is equating the abyss with the sea, spiritually speaking. The beast comes from the abyss. The beast comes from the sea. Abyss and sea are the same thing symbolically here in Revelation. This is how you would interpret it. And that explains a great mystery we'll encounter at the very end in chapter 21. When the abyss is emptied in chapter 21 and judgment happens, there is no more need for the abyss, right? But the way John puts it in chapter 21 is the first heaven and the first earth will pass away and the sea no longer exists. And that has confused people for thousands of years. But by understanding the spiral structure of Revelation, we know John is speaking of the abyss, the prison for evil spirits, where this beast came from. That prison for evil spirits, the abyss, will no longer exist. In Revelation 21, he's not talking about the literal ocean. He's talking about the sea, the abyss, the spiritual sea. So I'll remind you of this when we get to chapter 21. But for now, just know that when John says the sea will no longer exist, he doesn't mean the oceans and bodies of water that we know and love are going to disappear in the new heaven and the new earth. They will still be a big part of all that is made new. It is the abyss that will no longer exist. So back to the story. The hallmark of this beast, this ruler, is his blasphemy. He tolerates the Jews and even lets the temple operate normally for the first 3.5 years. But halfway through, he's going to do a 180. The dragon already gave him power and authority over all the other nations. But in the final 3.5 years, he's also allowed to desecrate the temple and persecute God's people, who in John's view would be Israel. In that last 3.5 years, they're no longer protected. This beast is able to conquer them. In the Hebrew Bible, this time period, even outside of Daniel, is called Jacob's distress. We Christians call it the Great Tribulation. The entire world worships the beast, everyone except those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And we know this is the book that of the names of those who have done righteousness and justice in the world. So John is saying that those who do righteousness and justice are obviously not going to be worshiping this blasphemous beast. He ends this section repeating what he said to each of the seven churches just before he told them what their reward would be. He says, "Whoever has ears, let them hear." But what he tells the seven churches this time is not their reward for overcoming. This time, he tells them what they must first endure. He says, "Whoever is to go into captivity will go. If it is necessary for someone to be killed by the sword, it will happen." This is where the endurance and faith of God's people will be critical. We need to stop here because that doesn't sound like God's people are going to get raptured before all this happens, does it? We'll start with that question next week. We're going to go into the rapture next week. But for now, let's ponder Daniel's timeline for a bit. What did y'all talk about, and what did you think?
Joe, you want to start with what you said with about the clues?
So, sure. I started with, I don't know what to do with any of this, because I get the reference to Daniel and I get that the timeline works. But then, so I made the comment that my newest granddaughter, she has two markers. So instantly, what do all of us do? We spiral into the future and we create things based on a clue of this and a clue of that and a clue of this, when the truth is, we don't know. We don't know. And I kind of think that's where I stand on this, that maybe it's just a lot of supposition. And can I be completely wrong? Of course. But
Then
as we
what?
talked about, if this is heaven on earth, because I think that we do a whole lot of, and Martha, how about if you jump in and talk about the Jewish part, the Jewish philosophy on God?
Okay, sure. So, a friend of mine who goes to church with me spent some time in a Jewish Reform congregation. And he mentioned the other evening that one of the things that he really appreciates is the unexplainability and the indescribable nature of God. And that that's, important to Jewish folks. And in this context, I connect it to some other things that I've thought and said about we spend so much time trying to explain the unexplainable and twist ourselves, 8 ways to Sunday to figure it out. Paul did the same thing. And I'm wondering about this author, presumably Jewish, right?
Yeah,
Who's
pretty
looking
most
back and going,
likely. Yeah.
so what do we do with the book of Daniel? All of these things that have happened, I'm looking at the world around me. Here's what I understand about Jesus. Oh, wait, there's this book of Daniel. I got to do something with that.
Yep.
Whether Daniel was intended for this or not, he needed to go back and look at this book that's in the Jewish canon. That he needed to do something with that, whether something needed to be done with that.
Well, yeah, he can't. He's saying if Jesus is coming imminently, he can't come unless all these things happen.
Oh, I know the other thing was how
Prophecy
did,
has to be fulfilled, right?
right. And I wasn't in the class around the time of the Daniel discussion, so I don't know where you all landed on that. But how does Daniel get to be a prophet of the future when we can generally talked about prophets being prophets of the present?
Yeah, exactly. They tend all Hebrew prophets, almost 100% of them. If you go back and read their prophecies, they are sent to a particular king, to a particular people, to in their time frame, and they prophesy right to them by name. I mean, they call them out by name and they say, you need to straighten up and fly right, and here's what's going on. And if you don't do it, all these terrible things are going to happen, natural consequences, right? You're depending on these nations are going to overrun you. Not cool. But almost every time as the Holy Spirit is speaking to this prophet, he morphs over to what happens after that. It's like the Holy Spirit has this arc, and it always arcs into this time of peace and restoration, and how God is going to draw them all back from their destruction and heal them entirely. They will know him. He will dwell with them. They will dwell with him. It happens over and over and over and over in prophecy that they start concrete and they morph into this future period.
Okay.
And I think part of that is because God is just never going to leave us without hope. God is never going to leave us, and God is never going to leave us without hope, without knowing there is something beyond our suffering. In the Hebrew Bible, in the Hebrew language, there's a guy who does some great work, named Jeff Benner, who does a lot of work with how the language is constructed. And he talks about a lot what other scholars talk about as well, is that Hebrew is a language of concreteness, of things, not abstract ideas. And so hope is an abstract idea.
So is faith.
The word for hope in Hebrew is the exact same word as for the rope that the prostitute Rahab let down the wall of Jericho for the Jewish spies, for
Oh,
the Hebrew spies.
huh.
Okay? It's our rope. That is how they convey hope in their language.
Kind
And
of
that
like a
is what these
lifeline.
prophecies are, okay? They are this rope.
Kind of like
So,
a lifeline, Gail.
yes,
Yeah.
exactly.
Do you see the writer of Revelation operating in the same way?
Yes, I do. Now, he does not strike me. He is not writing like the Hebrew prophets wrote. I mean, if you read the Hebrew prophets, how he writes is very different. The message is very different, and it really makes me feel like he's writing a story and filling these bits in.
Right.
But That said, he does follow that same arc. He does, because he has to. He has to get to a place of everything being resolved, and God, and everything being good, and everything, and all evil, being dissipated. It just evil flees from God. Is he a Hebrew prophet? I don't know. I think he's writing a story. I think he's trying to tell his congregations, here is how this stuff could work. It's got to work. Here's how he sees it. Is it inspired? Is it true? Is it literally what's going to happen?
Who
I
knows?
think all of scripture is inspired. I think
Inspired.
it's all helpful. I think Revelation, there was a good reason it was maybe in the canon, maybe not, I think we should take all of this filler with a grain of salt. I
So on
don't
that
think,
note,
I think we do ourselves a disservice trying to make it literal, trying to say, oh, it's that politician, or it's this thing, or it's that thing. People have been doing
it's the
that for
spiral.
thousands of years. That's not the point. I think it's much more helpful to simply say, what is this telling us about God?
It's the spiral.
And just leaving it at that. So.
I think all of this tells us a lot about people, but people are, flawed and imperfect and all of that. If we can sort of separate that or let that fade to the background and focus on what does this tell us about God? I remember taking a study series years ago when my husband was alive called Disciple, and there were like four different, and they were school year long studies. And the question it asked about everything we read was, what does this tell us about God? And I got so annoyed at that question because I wanted to know how, what it instructed me to do, not what did it tell me about God. And now I wish I could go back and redo that with the lens, with the filter, for what does this tell us about God? And if I've gotten nothing else, and of course I have gotten so much more, but if I've gotten nothing else from this gentle ramble, it's looking at who God is, what he is, how he is, and that hope and love and getting to know who he is. And I think the rest of this is kind of superfluous. We're not going to know. I was saying in our group, the tribulation and then the great tribulation is makes me sad to think that there's going to be times that it's worse than it is right now, because there's so much bad going on in the world. I just watched a show about child sex trafficking, and there are more children in slavery to that business, because it is a business, then there have been slaves throughout the entire history of the world, and certainly of the US. And I mean, it's just sickening to think about that. And that's just one aspect of evil. And to think that it's going to get so much worse
What if this is the
makes
worst
me
thing?
sick.
What if it's an ebb and flow?
Maybe, yeah, I don't know.
Exactly. I
It's
think
not ebb and flow.
also just I would pair this with, I want to point out to you that Jesus pairs who is God? What does this tell me about God? And what is God with how we treat each other and what we do? It's never a we're just going to look in the sky kind of thing. Okay. It's really, really important to pair those two things. And what John is trying to tell his congregations is hang on there and continue, even though it's hard.
Gail, you the way you told the story today, you used really literal language for Satan losing Satan's place in heaven. Satan now resident on earth with all of Satan's power. And you told that really matter-of-factly. Is that, were you telling the story or is that what you believe?
I see all of Revelation as an archetypical story, okay? And so are the people and events. I see good and evil in Revelation. And throughout, and it is being told from a Hebrew perspective. I'm trying to honor John's perspective. That's why I'm telling it like that. I'm trying to tell it like he would tell it, okay? While also pointing out to you the pitfalls and the context and all the things. But I will say that it is a very Hebrew concept that Satan was created at the uber level, even above the archangels, quote, morning star, just the best of the best, and somehow thought he should be better. He deserved better than that, and that he should be God, basically. That is a very Hebrew kind of understanding. There is definitely an understanding that Satan enters in and out of heaven and goes to and from the world and heaven, just as the rest of the angels do, like the angels do, and that God has dialogue with Satan, and that Satan has certain powers. Like in the Hebrew understanding, angels have particular responsibilities over particular nations, like Michael over Israel and some of the other angels over Persia, et cetera, et cetera. So that Satan's is perceived as being the whole world, right? In the Hebrew understanding. And it is from this Hebrew lens that we hear Jesus say to his disciples after he had sent them out. And they came back and said, we did it. We healed people. We did things. We did miracles happen. We survived. Not only survived, we did it. He said, yes, I know. And I saw Satan fall from heaven. This is the context he's speaking from.
Martha, I want to follow up with something that you mentioned at the end of our thing. You said something about Dr. Amy Jill Levine or
Yeah,
Levine
Levine.
and that her work on it, and then Julia mentioned she'd taken a class. And so while the break was transitioning, I typed in Amy Jill Levine thoughts on Revelations. And she says, according to her, that it's an intense, highly symbolic product of intergrouped sectarian conflict, arguing that its infamous synagogue of Satan references target non-Jewish outsiders or Gentile interlopers rather than Jesus. And her warning for misinterpretation is that failing to contextualize apocalyptic and polemic phrases or polemical phrases in texts like Revelations leaves them open to be weaponized, historically feeding into Christian anti-Judaism and modern anti-Semitism. Responsible reading would be to acknowledge how first century rhetoric functioned internally so that modern interpreters do not perpetuate hatred or super suppression of suppressions against Jews.
Thank you.
All of the above.
Kind of just like, like you're saying, modern text, old text. Through
And
the
I'm
lens
glad,
of.
I appreciate you pointing that out, Martha, also that I'm using John's voice. I'm glad that you let me clarify that. So pretty interesting, huh?
It really is.
I'm
Studying
somebody we.
this.
Well, Julia, let's do Julia first and then Martha.
I was just going to say, this all reminds me of, it's been many, many years, maybe 25 years since I read it, but when I read the Spinoza's On God and the rabbit trails it took me down, this reminds me of that so much, so much. And it's been a long time. I find that book refresh.
Martha, what were you going to add?
Oh, I was just gonna say something that was actually probably kind of snarky, but how many weeks are we gonna spend on Revelation?
I tell you what, we're about to spend 2 weeks on the rapture, because that has had such an impact on Christian belief and Christian actions and how Christians walk in the world. And I want you to know what there is to know about it. I was just going to spend one, but I went back and I put a second one in because I was like, I can't leave out the stuff I was going to leave out. Just can't do it. They need to know this. So really, we've got 2 weeks on the rapture, which is like a side trip. And then we'll come back and we have 3 weeks to finish Revelation.
Okay.
All right. Hang in there. You can do it. Love you all. See you next
Love
week.
you too.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.